Welcome to a reading from Katrina Naomi and Sarah Howe, and thanks, of course, to the Arts Council who support the festival. Katrina Naomi's new book, The Way the Crocodile Taught Me, published by Seren, is available at the back. I used to be a very, very fortunate person. Katrina used to live down the road from me. I've been to her flat for tea. I've been to her party. And do you know what she did? She went to move to Blooming Penzance. I mean, what good's that to me? And not only that, she started posting about the wonderful life she was having down there. Beautiful photos of the coast and walks she'd done and swimming in the sea. Not fair. And of course, there's always her poetry. Kim Moore picked one of the poems from this book. You might have seen Kim here earlier in the week. She keeps a blog, and every week she posts a Sunday poem, and she chose Katrina's letter to my mother from in here a little while ago. And she wrote, "When I got to the end of this poem, with its lines about forgiveness, I had to put the book down and catch my breath." And Gillian Clark, until recently the National Poet of Wales, said of the book, "These are fiercely and triumphantly female poems written with..." Can't read my own writing. "Brave truth," I think that says, sorry. "It's a vivid collection of elegy and celebration." Katrina's also the only person I know who's had a poem written for her by Sharon Olds. I can't wait to hear this collection. It's available at the back from Three Counties Bookshop, and she'll sign it at the end. Please welcome Katrina Naomi.
Hello. It's really lovely to be here. It's the first time I've been at Ledbury, and just got here tea time yesterday, and I already think it's a fab festival. So, like quite a few of the poets here, I've been asked by English Pen to read a poem and to say a little bit about one of the poets that's persecuted because of their poetry. You may already know about English Pen, a literature and human rights charity. Their aim to defend writers' rights to freedom of expression. And we're all reading this as part of Poetry as Protest. The poet I'm talking about is Liao Xia from China. She is a founding member of the independent Chinese Pen Center. Liao Xia is married to the imprisoned poet Liao Xiaobo and has been under extra legal house arrest since he won the Nobel Peace Prize in October 2010. And I'm going to read one poem by Lia, and it's dedicated to her husband Xiaobo. The poem is called June 2nd, 1989. "This isn't good weather," I said to myself, standing under the lush sun. Standing behind you, I patted your head, and your hair prickled my palm, making it strange to me. I didn't have a chance to say a word before you became a character in the news. Everyone looking up to you, as I was worn down at the edge of the crowd, just smoking and watching the sky. A nice myth, maybe, was forming there, but the sun was so bright I couldn't see it." For the rest of the session, I'll be reading poems from The Way the Crocodile Taught Me. Bear with me, I've got a cough, which is not exactly what you need when you're reading. Okay. I'm going to begin with a poem from my mum. And you know when you're a teenager and you're often really quite embarrassed by your mum's clothes? My mum used to have one of these terrible swimming hats, you know, with all the flowers all over them. And me and my sister just thought it was the most hideous thing ever. And of course, now I'd love one because, you know, really kitsch and I think lovely. So this is yellow dahlias. This is the image that sticks. My married mother, her costume cut low and high. 1 foot below the impossible blue of a honeymoon pool. The other poised on the metal step, her face fresh of makeup. Brows plucked in static surprise. Eyes wide with the rubber pull of yellow dahlias. Her new ring and bracelet. A triumph. My mother emerging from the water as I'd never seen her before. Her head a Belisha beacon of hope. The first part of this new collection are family poems, and I'll read a selection from those. I wrote a sequence of poems about my stepfather, he was a pretty terrible man, and a sequence about my nan, who was a lovely person. So I'm going to read two poems from the stepfather sequence. I hope that maybe from this poem will make you see why I didn't think much of him. Willpower. He couldn't say no to a fried egg sarnie smeared with daddy's sauce. Eating two as a snack. Other days, our stepfather barely ate, yet was up at 4, his engine running as he lifted truckloads of turf. He was always jumpy, mostly in a temper in our front room. We were all hemmed in by the giant sofa. When he didn't eat, he was worse, resenting the lack of food, his 17 stones, me, the eldest, who ate what she wanted and stayed slim. And he couldn't eat or sleep after work, but sprawled on the couch in silk pajama bottoms, lolloping breasts bared as he flicked between channels, riffled through the sport and the people. He bought his slimming tablets, whiz, amphetamines, speed, in bulk in Thailand. Gave my sister 2 when she said she'd put on weight. She skipped breakfast, lunch, and tea. Her brown eyes buzzed through school. Her heart sprinted for days. She learnt to say no to his pills, his fried egg sarnies. His moods darkened, though he never hit us like he did our mother. I once told him to punch me, and his ice blue eyes screwed into mine, acid in the crease of his lips, his florid face too close. Then he'd catch the TV's whine of motor racing and heave his frame back to the sofa. And I'd escape, another drug bolting through my veins. Sometimes hate, sometimes pity, but always cut with fear. There's, I think, sort of one area with my stepfather where I felt maybe if only he could have sort of talked rather than lashed out, we might have got on. He was, I suppose, what people called then a cross-dresser, and it was all a huge secret, and none of us were to know about it. And I think it was, you know, I'd like to sort of think now, you know, we're a bit more open about such things, and people wouldn't, you know, wouldn't think that this was a terrible thing to be. But I think he had real problems about it, and might explain why he was quite such a difficult person to be with. So I wrote a poem in which I sort of tried to approach him in some way. Pop socks and manicures. Seeing the drag queens tonight, I wonder if I've ever applauded you and not known. Your wardrobe was always locked. I'd got used to your kimono, pop socks and manicures. Hair dye, eyelash tint, the annual trip to Thailand. I wouldn't have cared about a rack of dresses, several sizes larger than hers. Your huge stilettos. I wasn't that sort of child. I'm still not. I scan the faces of these men. Perhaps one night we won't argue. We'll sing. Just sing. See, my nan was a completely different sort of force in my life altogether. She was a great person. She was tiny, about 5 foot nothing. She really lived her life well, I think. Sort of no tin of Quality Street was safe anywhere near my nan, nor was gin, nor any other alcohol. So, you know, I think she was quite a good influence in life. I was the first person from my family to go on to college, to further education. And I think sometimes when you do that, it's like you don't think you've changed very much, but everybody else seems to treat you quite differently. I remember sort of the first time I came home and was talking, and I just sort of thought, oh, okay, things are different. What Nan said. On my first trip home from college, you've got ideas above your station. As if I should have stayed below stairs, never ventured out of our sitcom. I'd probably been showing off, talking politics in French. Nan didn't get to study. Some of us had to work for a living. I can translate all of this now I've travelled above ground. If Nan were still here, I'd try to tell her I'm still the same girl, la même. And my nan was always very free with her advice. It was usually very good advice. And I wished I'd listened a bit more. This is her advice after my partner's breakdown. What did you know of love? You who slept in a separate bed, separate room, who knew nothing of us. You told me to let him be, let him get on with it, let him alone. You gave me your harshest advice, told me what you'd done after Grandpa was discharged from the Navy, hiding from the merest sound from you. You made me hear every whistle and blast of your advice, and I never thanked you. Okay, I'm going to move on now into the second part of the book, which picks up on some of the sort of issues, perhaps from my family and childhood, but takes them off in different directions. And so these aren't sort of family poems. The woman who married the Berlin Wall. The woman who married the Berlin Wall fell in love at the age of 7, thrilling to this Berliner's slim sensuality, his horizontal lines, his sense of division, found the Great Wall of China far too stout. She used the words he or my husband, made models of her lover, took him on sleigh rides so he could enjoy her native northern Sweden. She papered her rooms from bulging scrapbooks. On her sixth visit, they wed, a small ceremony. She scratched her desire deep into his core, knowing he couldn't leave until he was demolished, chunk by chunk. She felt she owned him outright. I have some sympathy for a woman who could love a wall. I have practiced kissing tables, licking car seats, have pressed myself against an aeroplane's wing. It's actually a true story. There are two women who claim to be married to the Berlin Wall, one who's from Sweden and one who's from the States. But I just think it's all quite fascinating. Takes sort of fetishism to a whole new level, I think. This next poem is always quite a tough one to read. It might be quite a tough one to hear. The bicycle. I was okay. Nothing had happened. Nothing bad had happened. I couldn't get up from the bench. Couldn't do up my dungarees. It was cold. It was night. The man had gone, and that was good. I was okay. I could sit up, peel myself from the bench's slats, which had pressed deep inside. It could have been worse. I was shaking. It was night. The bicycle was too heavy. My dungarees kept slipping. Buttons were missing. I had to get home. It was so hard to walk. My head hurt, kept punching inside. My teeth couldn't stop talking. It could have been worse. My jaw hurt and my breasts were raw. I couldn't pick up the bicycle, its spinning wheel. Couldn't walk with the bicycle. I had to get home to wash, sleep, throw these clothes away. I was shaking. I was cold. My dungarees wouldn't do up. I would be all right. It was just this bicycle I needed. Okay, this is a lot lighter. I wrote this next poem, Bestial, after reading a wonderful poem by Monisa Alvey. I don't know if people in the audience know Monisa Alvey's work. Several nods, which is good to see. If you don't know her work, I'd suggest go and find some of her poems. I think she's a great poet. The poem I picked up on was one called All Fours, and I pinched that idea for the first line. And so this is Bestial after Monisa Alvey. My husband took to running on all fours, sniffed me to communicate, licked and nuzzled. For my birthday, he fetched peonies from the park, snapped at the roots in his teeth. He liked his arse in the air, balls swinging like a lion's in their hairy nest. His shoulder blades triangled, winged, as if he might leave rectangular contact with earth, become a little Pegasus. Instead, he upped his mileage. Four legs good, he'd quote, at marathon officials. On our first anniversary, to prove my love and to help his posture, I took him to the optician, who made him spectacles with upward reflecting mirrors to keep his spine in line with his neck. He ran all the faster. One night, he asked to be excused from the table, lapped his food from a silver dish at my feet, slept at the foot of the bed. Sex was barely any different to before, but I had to lower myself for his kisses. I balked at his pleading for a collar and lead, initially. This is the title poem of my collection, The Way the Crocodile Taught Me. I swooned at the large god of him, sunning, a tooth for every day of my life. He performed his run along the bank, as males do. I brought my boat closer. He took to following at a distance. I wasn't taken in, knew his four-chambered heart pumped love out and in and out, knew his tongue had few good uses, knew all about his grin. Yet whoever said he was cold-blooded has never truly known this beast. He brought out the prehistoric in me. I dived. We swam belly to belly to where the Niles meet. Tussled as we thrashed among the weeds. After, I lay the length of him, a limestone lilo, studs patterning my skin. He smiled at me, often, taught me all he knew. Years later, when a man tried to drag me under, I practiced the force my lover had held back, levered my small jaws open to their furthest extent, splashed them down on the human's arm. My attacker still carries the mark of my smile. And I'm going to finish with the last poem in the book, which I've sort of tried to bring the collection together in terms of sort of melding some of the issues from the second part and the issues from the first part. Thank you very much for listening. The poem is called Mantra, and I'd like to read it for my mum. Staring into the golden eyes of Buddha, I wanted to believe. On the trek to the foothills, I queued at the entrance to a cave, handed over 200 rupees to the 80-year-old lama in red robes, amber beads, a smurf hat. I was curious about isolation, how someone could live so far from people. Yet here we were, 12 of us, along with his wife, who grew spinach in the hills and checked our money. The lama smiled more than the nuns, more than any of our priests. He had to angle his chin to look into my face. I ignored the hint of flirtation, wanted to believe this glint was enlightenment. Remembered my first Holy Communion, and for an instant I forgot about the cold, the money, my blisters, the rest of the group. I summoned a space to take what I could, though Mum would have questioned why the lama hadn't washed his robes. I'd have explained about the luxury of water up here. She'd have frowned her no excuse for dirt look. As the lama knotted a mantra into a cord, stood on tiptoe, raised his arms and placed the cord around my neck, a mini garland, a bootlace tie of red and yellow. I knew it was mass-produced. Imagine devotees, or his wife, lumbering a bale of it up to the cave, as the old man muttered. I meant to ask about the colours, but thought again of my mum, not long dead. I took the blessing for her. In her last few years, she'd asked me to light candles, knowing I didn't believe. I'd entered churches, heard the coins drop into the silence of a black box, watched the fake flames twitch below a gaudy saint, just in case this act could make a difference. And I thought again how even in death she was buried below that man she'd come to hate, a man who'd begun building her a rockery, taking her to dinner, and ended up telling her what she could and couldn't wear, what colour to dye her hair, when she could take the dog for a walk and for how long, what she could eat, who she could speak to, who'd read her letters before she did, who'd married her and hit her, I don't know how many times, she wouldn't say. Her first husband went off with another woman who didn't have children, didn't live in a council house, didn't have to save to pay the gas bill in a red tin box, hearing the coins fall, the box shaken and weighed each week. Yes, I took the blessing for her, raped at the age of 17, who'd told no one apart from her husband's, who'd used this knowledge against her. And then she told me, just before she died. I took what the Lama offered. Mum would have liked the ritual, the incense, the views. I wore the cord with its simple knot, like a vow, until we reached the pass at Thorong La, 5 days later, the highest I'll ever walk. I burrowed beneath my layers, lifted the cord from my neck, looped it to a rope of prayer flags with a knot a mariner might approve of. I left it whipping in the Annapurna winds, way above the snow. It was safe to cry then, at having come that far, the closest I'd get to her again. Later, I followed the scree path down, lungs and brain gulping at oxygen, down to sweet ginger tea. Mum stayed, repeating her mantra to the mountains, for 6 months, maybe a year, before the cord unravelled, and then she'd be free. Thank you.
Oh, it's wonderful to be in the same neighbourhood as Katrina again, even if only for a little while. I'm sure you feel the same. And I bumped into Nick Murray here at the beginning of the week, and he's the man behind Rack Press, who published Katrina's last pamphlet, Hooligans. And he told me that it was the fastest selling first run that his press had ever produced. So let's hope this does the same. Last year, on Monday the 28th of September, I was sitting in the festival hall and I felt a tingle. I was looking at the lineup of the nominees for the Ford Prize for Best First Collection, and I felt the poetry establishment was about to shift a bit on its axis. Not only was it quite possibly the hottest looking lineup of a poetry reading, but it was one of the most diverse lineups of one of the big traditional prizes. There were two men and three women, and the three women were all fellows of a scheme called the Complete Works, which was created by Spread the Word and backed by the Arts Council to try and improve the diversity of publishing in this country, poetry publishing. And so far there have only been 20 poets who've gone through that scheme, and the fact that three of them were sitting on that stage was fantastic, and not at all surprising that Complete Works has just taken its third intake, so there are going to be 10 more poets watch this space. So who were those nominees? There was Matthew Siegel, whose work had won prizes in America that had led to it being published here. There was Karen McCarthy Wolfe, whose book won the Fenton Albright and the Observer prizes. There was Mona Arshi, who won the prize that night. There was Andrew McMillan, who's won almost every other prize going. And there was Sarah Howe, who's about to read to you now. And her book, Loop of Jade, published by Chatto, also available at the back, and she will also stay to sign it, won, I'm sure you know, the T.S. Eliot Prize 2015. And Pascal Petit, who was the chair of the judges for the T.S. Eliot Prize, described the book as absolutely amazing, and how it shone with its startling exploration of gender and injustice through place and identity, its erudition and powerful imagery, as well as her daring experiments with form. She brings new possibilities to British poetry, and that's definitely the feeling that I had that night. So please welcome Sarah Howe.
Oh, thank you, Katrina, for that powerful reading, and Jill for that lovely introduction. It's so nice to be here at Ledbury. I've already had an ice cream today, which is not usual at poetry festivals, I think, so I'm very happy. I was last here for the first time 6 years ago when I got up on this stage as an absolutely petrified Eric Gregory winner, when I was still quite new to the whole idea of public readings, and I guess I'll always be grateful to Ledbury for that boost in confidence. I thought I would start with a poem called The Walled Garden, because I know that this place has a rather lovely one of those. This poem is actually about Cambridge, but we'll ignore that. The Walled Garden. Across the road, the girls quit school in threes and fours, tripping off at speed to stations or familiar cars, their silhouettes slung with shoulder bags and hockey sticks like mules. Remember, says the afternoon. The shut door shudders brassily beneath my hand. It is already dark or darkening. That sky above the dimming terraced rose goes far beyond a child's imagining. I tread along the back street where the cabs cut through behind the luminous science labs, their sills of spider plants in yogurt pots among the outsized glassware cylinders like pygmies contemplating monoliths. You cannot walk the other side because the walled garden meets the road direct. In pools of spangled tarmac after rain, the open gutter choking up with leaves. As though to listen, the colossal trees lean out into the tungsten-haloed street. I meet another on the road. This snail's slow ribbon turns the asphalt into gold. I thought I would read a couple of newer poems which aren't in the book. I've got into the habit of reading these uncollected poems on my iPad, which is usually fine, except until recently I was in Newcastle doing a reading at the university and it picked up a Wi-Fi network and my dad FaceTimed me in the middle of the reading. So I'm now careful to put it into airplane mode. This first new poem is a sonnet. It's one that was commissioned for National Poetry Day last year, whose theme was light. And I thought that it was the perfect chance to write a poem in honour of the centenary of Einstein's special theory of relativity, which fell last November. And so I wrote this poem about, well, I suppose, the physics of light, and dedicated it to Professor Stephen Hawking because, well, it seemed that the apotheosis of the science of light is black holes in lots of ways. And amazingly, Professor Hawking agreed to read this poem as part of a collaboration, so you can actually listen to it online on YouTube in his voice. He was so kind. He said, when I wrote to him, he said, come and have dinner with me and we can talk about how this could work. And so I had some of the most nerve-wracking small talk I think I've ever experienced, protracted over the course of 2 hours, because it takes him 15 minutes to compose a single sentence. Astonishing man. And at one point he said, I'm not sure I have a very good voice for reading poems. It was originally designed as a telephone directory. At which point I said, I'm sure it's the very best sort of voice for reading poems. Anyway, so this sonnet has two experiments in it. One is the actual physical experiment, which demonstrates the wave-particle nature of light. You can actually shine a beam of light through a slit, and what starts out as a particle on one side, by the other side, shining on a screen, is an interference pattern, so it's become a wave. And the other experiment is a thought experiment, such as Einstein was so fond of. In one of them, he rides on a beam of light. This one is the one with the hurtling train and the clock and the light beam. And that's what's referenced here. Relativity, for Stephen Hawking. When we wake up brushed by panic in the dark, our pupils grope for the shape of things we know. Photons loosed from slits like greyhounds at the track reveal light's doubleness in their cast shadows that stripe a dimmed lab's wall, particles no more. And with a wave, bid all certainties goodbye. For what's sure in a universe that Doppler's away like a siren's midnight cry? They say a flash seen from on and off a hurtling train will explain why time dilates like a perfect afternoon. Predicts black holes where parallel lines will meet, whose stark horizon, even starlight, bent in its tracks, can't resist. If we can think this far, might not our eyes adjust to the dark? And the next new poem I thought I would read is actually the one from the Ledbury anthology, Huat. It is a poem in memoriam of a Chinese poet called Xu Lizhi, who you might have seen. You might have seen both his name and his work going by on the internet, because his work went viral for the saddest of reasons in 2014. He was a Foxconn factory worker in Guangdong province in China, which just happens to be the province my mum is from, where he was manufacturing Apple products on the factory floor. And, well, the conditions in these factories are well known, and there has been such a rash of suicides in the last few years amongst the workers that Foxconn actually strung up nets below the dormitory windows, meaning that Xu Lizhi, when he came to kill himself in 2014, when he couldn't take any more, had to go to a nearby building to jump. And this is called On a Line by Xu Lizhi. I swallowed a moon made of iron, you sang. The one who would stare from a fourth-story sill, waiting for the brunt lick of dormitory fan to come round again. Pitched in the grimy glass, your still young face electroplates with lunar currents. It clogs the sky. overtime, dense as a dentist's drill. You are shower-capped again in the assembly line, your eyes acid-etched circuitries, where fatigue's fluorescent scrim settles like dawn. You float between the rows, ministering to never-ending components, their hands a flight of chrome, tongue soldered by thirst. You sway, could almost reach the cartoon bulb twitching hot above your head. Later in your bunk, among strangers hauled from sundry provinces who fart like dogs in their sleep, you write down a line about the screw that fell with an unheard plink to the factory floor. Words I read on a screen that reels at my touch and choke, then tap the next link. And now I thought I would read the poem that I'd chosen as part of the Poetry as Protest initiative with English Pen this year. I was very moved to hear Katrina's reading of Liu Xia's work, which has been a great inspiration to me, but entirely unknown to me before this project was the work of Mahvash Sabet, who is currently serving a 20-year prison sentence in Tehran as one of seven Baha'i leaders who were imprisoned for their faith and activities in the country. Penn encouraged me to write to Mahvash and send her a couple of books, which I did, to what must be the simplest and saddest address ever, Mahvash Sabet, Evin Prison, Tehran, Iran. That was all I wrote on the envelope, and I hope that it will reach her. And if you find yourself moved to write to Mahvash or any of the other imprisoned poets around the world, you can find details on the Penn website as to how to do that. Mahvash began writing poems only after her arrest in 2008, and her collection, Prison Poems, was published in English in 2013. This particular poem was adapted from the Persian by Bayayi Nakshavani. Hello again. Last night, in the midst of unsettled darkness, I found myself at the axis of the earth for a moment, holding it taut between my outstretched arms. And as I struggled to keep those frozen poles apart, I saw I could prepare these icy limbs and melt them wondrously between my two hot palms. So I stood there on the summit of the loftiest peak, a simple woman, glowing with love again, ready to salute the world once more. Now, I thought it would make sense to read something from the title poem of my book, Loop of Jade. But the title poem is about 8 or 9 pages long, so I won't make you suffer through all of it, but I thought I'd pick out a few fragments. The poem has its title because of this, which is a jade bracelet sized for a baby's wrist that was bought for me by my Chinese grandmother, who actually wasn't my grandmother at all, but the woman who took in my mother as an abandoned baby shortly after she was born in Guangdong in 1948. The poem tells this story, but the reason these objects are put on the wrists of babies is because it's believed that they'll protect the toddler if he or she should fall. The bracelet will smash rather than the child being hurt. And this just seemed to me such a potent symbol for what it was I was searching for in writing this book, something which could represent a line of continuity as I was trying to connect or reconnect with my Chinese heritage, but also something which, like the line of inheritance to my Chinese ancestors, will always already be broken in some sense. So I'll read a couple of the prose fragments in this poem. They're so fragmentary because this is how this story was told to me. I mean, I'd known that my mother was an orphan, but I really didn't know anything about the detail of her early life until I was well into my 20s, when she would start to talk late at night when everyone else had gone to bed, and I would get these snippets, which is sort of what I tried to convey in this poem. So I'll read a couple of those, and then the last section, which switches back into verse. So this is from Loop of Jade. When the television has stayed on too long, the channels ended, and all the downstairs lights switched off but one. Sometimes, rarely, my mother will begin to talk without prelude or warning about her growing up. Then her words feel pulled up from a dark and unreflective well, willed and not willed. It isn't that this tacit contract is not tinged by our same daily fumblings, but when the men are asleep, I think she believes it's someone else's turn to listen. Once she spoke of her horror as a very small child, of the communal kitchen in their low-rise tenement. Half outdoors in that muggy climate, it ran across the whole row, a corridor or terrace. This space, aside from housing a blackened static wok the size of a Western baby's bath, was also a latrine. Of squatting barefoot over the cracked tile trench and trying not to breathe. How, despite themselves, her eyes would follow to the nearby drain as it sprouted. Here she giggles, shivers, the glistening bodies of cockroaches like obscene sucked sweets. I see them, the colour of rust or shit, hitching up from the crusted grill on agile legs. Things scuttling from some dank subterranean chamber of the head. Another time she tells of being made in the bucket room at a place she always calls a school to wash her hair with a green detergent meant for scouring floors, shaken from a cardboard tube. Unconscious fingers reach towards her scalp. I do not look for the candied rose petal patches there as long as I remember, as of mange or burns. That tell why, before leaving the room, she will so carefully layer and arrange her lovely black hair. It thuds into my chest, this pendant ring of milky jade. I wear it strung on an old watch chain, meant for a baby's bracelet. Into its smooth circlet, I can just fit a quincunx of 5 fingertips. Cool on my palm it rests, the sinople eye on a butterfly's wing. When I was born, she took it across to Wong Tai Sin, my mother's mother, to have it blessed. I saw that place, its joss-stick incensed mist, the fortune-casting herd, their fluttering tree-tied pleas, only later, as a tourist. As for the jade, I never wore or even saw it then. The logic runs like this. If baby falls, the loop of stone, a sacrifice, will shatter in her place. Painfully knelt on the altar step, did the old woman shake out a sheath of red-tipped sticks and pick one to entreat my fate? And if I break it now, will I be saved? I thought I'd end by reading a few poems from a sequence that runs down the whole length of the book. It's a sequence of 14 poems that each take their titles from a passage, I'm sure many of you will know it, in this wonderful essay by the Argentine writer Jorge Luis Borges, where he's describing the entry on animals from a certain Chinese encyclopedia, which is, of course, not really Chinese at all, because the entries in this encyclopedia for animals are things like embalmed, tame, sucking pigs, having just broken the water pitcher, that look like from a long way off, that from a long way off look like flies. And I thought that this was the perfect thing to steal a bunch of poem titles from. I guess being half English, half Chinese, I always thought that this bit of wry chinoiserie of Borges's was somehow describing me. This poem is the first in the sequence, and I guess it comes out of my confusion as a small child, recently moved to England. I didn't understand the difference between the Chinese legends and fairy tales and myths that my mum would tell me at night, I think in an effort to keep me connected with China. I couldn't understand the difference between those and things like Hans Christian Andersen's Emperor and the Nightingale. And I suppose I've been inhabiting that space of perplexity ever since. This poem has some Italian in it. The Italian words come from Madame Butterfly's most famous aria, where she is singing, he will call, because she imagines that her American husband, Pinkerton, who has abandoned her, will be coming back. Belonging to the Emperor. Today, my name is Sorrow. So sang the Emperor's first nightingale. The Emperor was a fickle god. He preferred to be thrilled by an automatic bird in filigreed gold. A music box, a leitmotif. Love me, please. Orange blossom. I see my father bathed in the blare of that same aria, prodding the remote to loop. Chiamerà, chiamerà. His face is red. Beneath his glasses, it is wet. My admiration for the work of poets like Liu Xia is part of a fascination that developed as I wrote this book about the mechanisms of censorship in China and the way that dissidents and creative writers and political activists have sought to circumvent the blocks on what can be said in that country's political discourse. And at the same time as writing the book, I started learning Chinese for the first time, which I hadn't actually grown up speaking. And one thing that struck me as I started to learn the language was just how many ways you can pun in Chinese that you can't in English. So the characters mean that sort of a dot or a line here or there can make all the difference, can make two characters which otherwise look almost exactly the same mean entirely different things. And also Chinese is just chock-a-block full of homophones, which is why it's a tonal language in the first place. So you almost have to fall over yourself to avoid punning the whole time. And so I thought it was amazing that people like dissident bloggers trying to get round the so-called Great Firewall of China, the system of keyword filters and blocks that just don't let you post certain phrases or words onto the Chinese language internet, that they use something like punning, a poet's traditional devices, to say what they need to say. This poem has an epigraph from a collection of Buddhist koans called the Gateless Gate, which goes, Baijiang picked up a water pitcher, set it on a rock, and posed this question. If you cannot call it a water pitcher, what do you call it? This is called Having Just Broken the Water Pitcher. This fact I can't forget. My 30th year had hastened by before I learned to see how plum blossom lies one sidelong stroke of gum-suspended soot away from regret. It said the man who invented writing, charged with this burden by the emperor, sought inspiration in the surface moods of water, that he was by the river when he spied in the finely cracking mud a hoof print, its brim still as a bronzed mirror, stamped there by some invisible creature, and understood his task. The moment he sketched the first character, the sky rained millet, and the ghosts wailed all night, for they could not change their shapes. 5,000 years later, in some remote coal mining district sits an anonymous blogger, his face lit by more than just the ancient monitor. He ponders how strange it is, how useful that I beg you for the truth is pronounced the same as I beg you, elephant of truth, or that sensitive words, as in filters, crackdowns, sounds exactly like breakable porcelain. Done typing, he clicks submit. Recall the old monk's koan, the correct reply to Master Baijiang's question. His pupil kicked over the pitcher and left. And I thought I would end with one last poem from this sequence. I tried for a long time to write a poem that would somehow encompass the rage that I feel at the phenomenon of missing women in Chinese society, whose presence you can only know from the gender ratio imbalance in the country, the fact that as of 2012, there were 40 million more men alive in China than women. And of course, where have these women gone these days to sex-selective abortion, lost to the traditional Confucian preference for sons who will continue the family line. But as I researched this poem, I discovered things like the ancient custom whereby a Chinese midwife would scrape a box full of ashes from the hearth and place it next to the birthing bed so that the parents, if the baby turned out to be a girl, could choose to efficiently smother her. And so I wrote this poem for all the girls who never existed, who have something in common with my own mum, who was probably abandoned because she was a superfluous girl and couldn't be looked after by her family, but for the ones who weren't as lucky as my mum. Tame. It is more profitable to raise geese than daughters. Chinese proverb. This is the tale of the woodsman's daughter, born with a box of ashes set beside the bed, in case. Before the baby's first cry, he rolled her face into the cinders, held it. Weak from the bloom of too much blood, the new mother tried to stop his hand. He dragged her out into the yard, flogged her with the usual branch. If it was magic in the wood, they never said, but she began to change. Her scar ridged back beneath his lashes, toughened to a rind. It split and crusted into bark. Her prone knees dug in the sandy ground and rooted, questing for water, as her work-grained fingers lengthened into twigs. The tree, a lychee, he continued to curse as if it were his wife, its useless, meagre fruit. Meanwhile, the girl survived, feathered in greyish ash, her face tucked in, a little gosling. He called her Maiming. No name. She never learned to speak. Her life maimed by her father's sorrow, for grief is a powerful thing, even for objects never conceived. He should have dropped her down the well, then at least he could forget. Sometimes when he set to work, hefting up his axe to watch the cleanness of his arc, she butted at his elbow, again, again, with her restive head, till angry he flapped her from him. But if these silent pleas had meaning, neither knew. The child's only comfort came from nestling under the lychee tree. Its shifting branches whistled her wordless lullabies. The lychees, with their watchful eyes, the wild geese crossing overhead. The fruit, the geese, they marked her seasons. She didn't long to join the birds, if longing implies a will beyond the blindest instinct. Then, one mid-autumn, she craned her neck so far to mark the geese wheeling through the clouded hills, it kept on stretching till it tapered in a beak. Her pink toes sprouted webs and claws. Her helpless arms found strength in wings. The goose daughter soared to join the arrowed skein, kin linked by a single aim and tide. She knew their heading and their need. They spent that year or more in flight. But where? Across what sparkling tundral wastes? I've not heard tell. Some say the fable ended there. But those who know the ways of wild geese know too the obligation to return to their first dwelling place. Let this suffice. Late spring, a woodsman snares a wild goose that spirals clean into his yard, almost like it knows. Gripping its sinewed neck, he presses it down into the block, cross-hewn from a lychee trunk. A single blow. Profit. Loss. Thank you.